Good evening. A hurricane threatens New Orleans. Massive flooding is already swamping the city. ICE gets ready for a mass sweep of undocumented persons, and Trump gives up on the census. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, July 11th, 2001. And President Donald Trump is expected to drop his bid to include a citizenship question on the 2020 census, according to House Republicans. Trump instead will pursue other avenues for collecting citizenship information after the Supreme Court blocked his census efforts, according to current and former administration officials familiar with the plans. Trump tweeted Thursday morning that he would be holding a news conference on the subject. A senior administration official speaking on condition of anonymity said they would be previewing the plans, and the president would announce a new executive action as part of the effort, but did not elaborate. Officials were still scrambling to finalize language in the hours after the tweet. And a hurricane warning has been issued for parts of Louisiana coast ahead of Tropical Storm Barry's arrival. The U.S. National Hurricane Center issued the warning Thursday afternoon for the Louisiana coast from Intercoastal City to Grand Isle. A tropical storm warning is in effect for other areas, including the New Orleans metro area. Earlier, severe thunderstorms prompted tornado warnings and inundated downtown New Orleans on Wednesday morning. The flooding occurred as Tropical Storm Barry gathered strength over the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, a state of emergency has been declared in Louisiana and the National Guard activated. Mandatory evacuations have been ordered in some places along the Louisiana coast. In New Orleans, the city advised residents to shelter in place. The National Hurricane Center declared Barry the second named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season, with maximum sustained winds of 40 miles per hour as the storm moves slowly west at about 5 miles per hour.
Going to be a lot of rain and going to be some storm surge. The other thing to mention here is slowly but surely the system making its way north into the weekend, and that means some heavy rains, not just a coastal event, but some heavy rains well up into Arkansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee with time. So we're going to keep an eye on that real close. Let's look at some of those impacts. I think it's really important to concentrate on those hazards. Look at the rainfall, just very large totals. Some of these areas could see anywhere from 15 to 20 inches of rain, maybe an isolated amount even higher than that. That's going to be a problem, and that's going to occur beginning tomorrow and into Saturday and through the weekend with time. And notice it's not just concentrated just over Louisiana. Some of these areas on the Mississippi coast, portions around Mobile could get some of that heavy rainfall into central portions of Louisiana. But look, all the way up into Arkansas, I mean, this area here, we're looking at the potential over there, that orange, 6 to 10 inches of rain. So there could be some floods deep, well inland with time. So we've got to really watch that. The other thing to look at is when you really look at those areas, the potential, I'm going to put another map up for you that I think is important, and it's not just the rainfall totals. This is the potential for flash flooding. And here you have a high risk, a moderate high risk, moderate risk, and even a slight risk. Notice what a large area that is. So we'll have to really keep an eye on the rainfall, and that is the leading cause of fatality. So watch out. And a lot of those are in automobiles. Let's be safe with this storm. Storm surge is another thing. We have a brand new storm surge warning up for portions of Louisiana where that water gets piled up. Any one of these areas in the pink could see values greater than 3 foot of storm surge. So once again, irregardless of whatever kind of development we get here, the issue will be water. We have to keep safe, and we'll just keep you updated as we get the new updates here at the National Hurricane Center right here in our operations area.
And forecasters say there's a good chance that Barry will become a Category 1 hurricane before making landfall along the Louisiana coast Friday night or Saturday. Danielle Manning is a National Weather Service forecaster in New Orleans.
Right now, Barry is still a tropical storm. However, it is forecast to be a hurricane before it makes landfall.
What does that mean for New Orleans?
Our biggest impact and our biggest concern at this point is water. We've got tremendous amount of rain in the forecast with this storm, forecasting 10 to, I believe, 15 inches of rain with isolated amounts significantly higher than that. So we're really going to be paying attention to where any banded features start to set up. And if they really start to train over the same areas, we could see some significant flash flooding.
Now, whenever we talk about New Orleans and this kind of flooding and hurricanes, we think back on Katrina. Could you tell us how this relates to that?
It's a completely different system, completely different scenario. The main mechanism for the flooding during Katrina had to do with a levee failure, or multiple levee failures, really. With this, we're going to be talking about a significant amount of rain in a relatively short amount of time. And whenever that happens, the drainage systems simply get overwhelmed.
Do you think that the facilities they have in place will be able to handle this in New Orleans?
There's absolutely potential that the pumping systems will be overwhelmed. The pumping systems, the advertised capacity is about an inch in the first hour and then a half an inch for every hour after that. And these kinds of tropical rainfall systems can drop several inches of rain in just a couple hours.
And what is that going to mean for the people living there? There's already been some evacuations called for. Is there going to be widespread evacuations, things like that?
I can't answer that question. The individual mayors and parish presidents are the ones that call for those evacuations, but I don't believe they're planning on that. Again, we can't really pinpoint where the heaviest rain is going to fall, so there's a lot of uncertainty as far as who's going to see the heaviest rain and exactly what kind of time frame that heaviest rain is going to fall in. You know, if we get the 10 to 15 inches spread out over the course of 48 hours, then it might not cause as many problems, but it'll still cause some river flooding in areas outside of New Orleans itself. But if we get that 10 to 15 inches in a few hours or over the course of maybe even 6 to 8 hours, that could cause some significant flash flooding.
And since you're talking about a hurricane and that is associated with wind, is there going to be any wind problems, any high winds, things like that?
New Orleans is currently under a tropical storm watch. Right now, based on the current forecast from the National Hurricane Center, we're not expecting any hurricane force winds within the city itself. But if the track does shift farther to the west, then the wind forecast would also increase for the city.
I see. And what is a hurricane exactly? Just to tell our listeners what a hurricane is officially.
Hurricanes are going to have winds greater than 75 miles per hour.
Right now, what's it at? It's below that right now.
Yes, sir, it is. I'm looking it up for you. Just 1 second. Current wind is 40 miles per hour.
And it's expected to go over 75 miles an hour later today?
It's forecast to be a Category 1 in about 48 hours.
What is a Category 1?
That's going to be that 75 mile per hour.
Will it go greater than that?
Let's see. No, that's the maximum. It's forecast to be 75 miles per hour at landfall.
Right.
And
just
we've got right now.
Is this a climate change induced event? Is this greater than anybody ever expected? Or is it just bad luck for New Orleans this time?
While we do expect the frequency of extreme events to increase in a warming climate, it's far too soon to tie any individual events to climate change. So we can't say how much climate change has affected this particular storm.
And New Orleans gets a lot of rain usually. Is this terribly unusual?
I know that a couple of places in the city did record more than the average monthly rainfall for the month of July in just a few hours the other day, yesterday morning. So yeah, we're definitely seeing more rain than normal.
I see. Great. Anything you'd like to add, please?
As always, just make sure that you're paying attention to the latest forecast updates, because even small changes in the forecast track can lead to significant changes in the expected impacts for any given area.
Danielle Manning is a National Weather Service forecaster based in New Orleans. Barry is the first hurricane of the 2019 Atlantic season. In August 2005, the much larger Category 5 hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Florida. It caused catastrophic damage in New Orleans as floodwaters broke through levees. At least 1,836 people died in the hurricane and subsequent floods, making Katrina the deadliest United States hurricane in 80 years. President George W. Bush was widely condemned for his response to the disaster, although the Coast Guard rescued 35,000 of 60,000 stranded people. 215 died in hospitals and senior centers. 45 bodies were recovered from Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans. There was also a violent confrontation at a bridge where police reportedly opened fire, killing several African-American people trying to escape the flooded parts of the city. And Labor Secretary Alexandria Acosta on Wednesday defied calls by congressional leaders to resign over the lenient 2008 plea deal he gave to child sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein. When Acosta And we're going to change that right now because the news is changing very quickly. The immigration raids that President Donald Trump threatened and put off are now set to start in the United States this weekend. Immigration activists in New York City say they've already responded to reports on Thursday that ICE agents were seen on the West 72nd Street platform of the 1, 2, and 3 trains just moments ago. Supporters of the new sanctuary movement responded, and no agents have been spotted at this hour. Immigration and Customs Enforcement will reportedly commence the arrests of potentially thousands of undocumented immigrants on Sunday. ICE agents are targeting at least 2,000 immigrants for deportation across 10 major cities and could also sweep up immigrants who aren't the initial targets. The executive director of the new sanctuary movement is Ravi Ragbir. He says Trump has been hot and cold on the sweep, but that his group is ready.
The president always blows hot air, but the fact is, whether or not it is hot air, we have to be ready. And being ready means that we have to assume that this is going to happen. And what is our response is what we are working on right now.
And what is your response? What do you think it'll be?
Well, our response is not just saying that they put them to stop a raid. What we want to mobilize is the community that is going to be affected to know what to do if ICE comes knocking on the door. It's not just about not opening the door, but they have to mobilize the community and the citizens that are supportive of them. So the other thing that we are mobilizing is the U.S. citizens to respond and to go to people's location if ICE is in the area and demand to see if at least a warrant that they will need to have if they're in the New York City region before they can go knocking on people's doors. We just heard a report this evening that ICE was on the 123 subway platform at 72nd Street, and immediately we started to mobilize people to go to 72nd Street to demand that they stop, to leave the subways and to stop accosting people and throwing fear to them.
Are people there right now on that subway platform?
So when we went, they didn't see anyone, but we are also going to have people throughout the day checking the platforms to make sure ICE is not there. And if ICE is there, like I said, mobilizing the community in that area to come out to that platform to stop what they're doing.
What rights does ICE have and what rights do people have? What I mean is that can ICE demand IDs from anybody they talk to, or do they have to have a warrant? And what should people do when they are confronted?
So ICE can only demand IDs from non-citizens. So a green card holder, obviously undocumented, someone has asylum. They're the only ones that they can demand IDs from. As citizens, they have no rights over a citizen. And whereas someone has to, if NYPD asks for an ID from a citizen, they have to show the ID. But ICE doesn't have the right or the power to ask a citizen for IDs, and people can and should refuse. Citizens should refuse to show the IDs to ICE. And if they want to show ID, the only ID they should show is the New York City ID, the ID NYC, because that's all that undocumented people will have. And we want to make sure that no one is picked up because they have an ID NYC. So every citizen must have an ID NYC now, and that's the only ID they should be using.
So how would they know in the first place if you are a citizen or not to ask you that question?
Exactly. So that's why we are saying to people, well, one is they obviously not going to ask a white person if they're a citizen, right, or if they for ID. So they're going to be very targeted. They're going to look for Latinos. They're going to look for black people. They're going to look for Caribbean people. So it's going to be very targeted and very profiling. And that's the first step in the assumption that all people of color, especially Latinos, are non-citizens. That's how they're going to ask. And people are going to assume that they have to show ID. If you're a citizen, you do not have to show them any ID. And if they want to arrest you, you have a right to file a lawsuit because you're a citizen, and this is unlawful detainment.
So will they have information from informants and things like that, intelligence beforehand, where they'll go to a place where they think there's going to be people?
They don't need that. We all know where the immigrant communities are. We all know where they live. We all know where they congregate. We all know where they work. And even though this is on the red line and there's not a lot of non-citizens living in the area, there are a lot of non-citizens who work in the area. So the way I would look at it is they have gone to the 72nd Street platform because they know that mostly white people live there. So they will basically target people of color and ask them for ID because they're assuming most of them are undocumented babysitters, grocery workers, etc., who are undocumented and therefore easy targets. So they will not have a list, but they will have a profile, which we know is a racism that is embedded in this immigration policy.
How about if they knock on people's doors?
If they knock on people's doors, well, that's what everyone is expecting them to do. They will be knocking on people's doors, but no one should be opening the doors because they need a warrant. They need a warrant to come into your home. But if you open the door, it means that you have invited them in and the warrant is not necessary. The only way they can force themselves into a property is if there is a judicial warrant from the court itself, not immigration court, Article 3 court has to issue this judicial warrant. And we have never seen a judicial warrant issue because immigration is not a criminal act. It is a civil process.
And if people are swept up and are held in an immigration jail, what should they do? What should they have on them in that emergency?
Well, what they should be doing beforehand is connecting to immigrant organizations so that if they are swept away, the immigrant organizations will have their information to challenge ICE, to hold ICE accountable so that no one's rights are violated, their due process are not violated. So it is not just the immigrant communities, the organizations that they need to connect to. They need to connect to others and making sure that the information is so that if you are undocumented, you will share with me, a friend, your information so that if you disappear, I will immediately call New Sanctuary or call whoever, and say, my friend was just picked, I don't see him. Can you help me find him if he's in immigration? He has never been picked up before, so he should be going to court. So that's why we're saying we are mobilizing the citizens to help and to be part of this network that we created to protect the community against ICE unlawful and inhumane process.
Okay, is there a phone number or any information you have for people to write down right now?
Sure, it's our website is newsanctuarynyc.org, newsanctuarynyc.org, and our phone number is 646-395-2925, 646-395-2925. So if you're a non-citizen, call us. If you're a citizen and want to volunteer and want to be part of this, we need you right now to stand up to this this hateful president.
Anything you'd like to add?
This is not a moment to be silent. This is not a moment to say, oh, I don't like what is happening, but I cannot do anything. You can do a lot because hate thrives in silence. And in the words of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, he said, it is not the violence of my enemies I will remember, it is the silence of my friends. So don't be quiet. Step up and be part of this process to stop this.
Thank you very much, Ravi. Take care.
And Ravi Rogbehr is the executive director of the New Sanctuary Movement. On June 17th, Trump tweeted that the following week, ICE would begin removing millions of undocumented immigrants from the United States. But on June 22nd, he said he would hold off for 2 weeks at Democrats' request to see if they could get together to work out a solution to the asylum and loophole problem at the southern border. And that's the president's quote. The House eventually passed the $4.5 billion border security bill that was opposed by progressive members such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as a cave-in to GOP xenophobia. New York City and state officials vowed last month to provide legal and other help to those targeted, and Mayor de Blasio joined mayors of major cities like Chicago, Miami, and Los Angeles in vowing not to cooperate with the sweep. And in breaking news just moments ago, President Donald Trump abandoned his controversial bid to demand citizenship details from all respondents to next year's census Thursday, instead of directing federal agencies to try to compile the information using existing databases. He said it is essential that we have a clear breakdown of the number of citizens and non-citizens that make up the United States. That was at a Rose Garden announcement just moments ago. He insisted he was not backing down. Trump's reversal comes after the Supreme Court blocked his efforts to include the citizenship question, and as the government had already begun the lengthy and expensive process of printing the census questionnaire without it. Trump had said last week that he was very seriously considering an executive order to try to force the question's inclusion, even though such a move would surely have drawn an immediate legal challenge. But he said Thursday that he would instead be signing an executive order directing agencies to turn records over to the Department of Commerce. He said, "We're aiming to count everyone." The American Community Survey, which polls 3.5 million U.S. households every year, already includes questions about respondents' citizenship. Critics have warned that including the citizenship question on the census would discourage participation, not only by those living in the country illegally, but also by citizens who fear that participating will expose non-citizen family members to repercussions. And members of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security heard expert testimony Wednesday challenging the federal government's policy of cannabis prohibition. The hearing, named Marijuana Laws in America, Racial Justice, and the Need for Reform, debating the merits of various alternative policy options, including abolishing POTS' longstanding criminal status under federal law. The committee was chaired by Representative Karen Bass, a California Democrat, and senior minority member Tom McClintock, also of California. Both parties say the pot issue is the greatest hope of bipartisan agreement in the House this year.
In 2017, there were over 600,000 marijuana-related arrests reported in the United States. Of these, almost 600,000 were arrests for marijuana possession in 1 year. Indeed, hundreds of thousands of people, the majority of whom are Black and Latino, have had their lives impacted by arrests and convictions for marijuana offenses. Since the time President Nixon declared a war on drugs in the early 1970s, the effect of this war on Black and Latino communities has been severely disproportionate. The war on drugs was racially biased from its inception, and it has been carried out in a discriminatory fashion with disastrous consequences for hundreds of thousands of people of color in their communities. Today, nearly 80% of people in federal prison and almost 60% of people in state prison for drug offenses are Black or Latino. A 2013 study by the American Civil Liberties Union found that on average, a Black person is 3.73 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person, even though Blacks and whites use marijuana at similar rates. These racial disparities in marijuana possession arrests exist in all regions of the country, in counties large and small, urban and rural, wealthy and poor, and with large and small Black populations. In recent years as a society, we have begun to examine the issues surrounding the disproportionate impact of the war on drugs and to develop policies and legislation to work against the devastation wrought by this war in the Black and Latino communities. Part of the devastation have been that we criminalize the health problem. While it is not in the jurisdiction of this committee, I do want to register the fact that some people do become addicted to drugs, including marijuana. And while we poured millions of dollars into incarceration, we did not put adequate resources into drug treatment. And while legalization is the direction many states are going, we need to make sure that a percentage of the revenue targeted that's earned from commercialization will go toward needed treatment services. In 1996, California became the first state to decriminalize marijuana for medicinal purposes, and more states have followed. Today, the majority of states, 33 in the District of Columbia, have decriminalized medical marijuana. Beginning with Colorado and Washington in 2012, 11 states, including most recently Illinois, have also begun legalized marijuana for adult recreational use. At the federal level, the criminal laws that pertain to marijuana are governed primarily by the Controlled Substances Act, or CSA as we often call it. The CSA was signed into law by President Nixon in 1971, and it established a scheduling system through which the federal government regulated the lawful production, possession, and distribution of controlled substances, including marijuana. Marijuana was initially placed and today remains on Schedule 1. As a result, a person who grows, possesses, uses, sells, transports, or distributes marijuana, even if it's done in a way that is consistent with state law or authorized by a state license, is nonetheless in violation of the CSA and remains subject to federal prosecution. In addition, because marijuana is still a federally controlled substance, the application of various money laundering and banking laws leaves many marijuana dispensaries being totally cash-only business, which in some instances can be dangerous and vulnerable to robbery. During the Obama administration, the Department of Justice issued guidance that made clear that the federal government would not pursue legal challenges against jurisdictions that authorize marijuana so long as those states and local governments maintain strict regulatory and enforcement control on marijuana cultivation, distribution, sale, and possession, limiting the risk to public safety, public health, and other law enforcement interests. The Trump administration rescinded that guidance to federal prosecutors and encouraged them instead to charge and pursue the most serious, readily provable offense. There is, therefore, a growing interest for this subcommittee to examine the laws that regulate marijuana and how Congress should respond to the growing trend toward legalization. The collateral consequences of even an arrest for marijuana possession can be devastating, especially if a felony conviction results. Those arrested can be saddled with a criminal conviction that can make it difficult or impossible to vote, obtain educational loans, get a job, maintain a professional license, secure housing, secure government assistance, or even adopt a child. These exclusions create an often permanent second-class status for millions of Americans. Like drug war enforcement itself, these consequences fall disproportionately on people of color.
And that's Representative Karen Bass, a California Democrat, speaking yesterday. Commenting on the hearing, NORML, that's a national organization for the reform of marijuana laws, political director Justin Streckel said, for the first time in a generation, members of Congress engaged in a candid conversation that acknowledged the failures of marijuana prohibition in the United States, how this policy has adversely impacted tens of millions of Americans, and how it must be reformed at the federal level. He added the ongoing classification under federal law of cannabis as a Schedule I controlled substance, a categorization that treats it in the same manner as heroin, is intellectually dishonest and has been scientifically debunked. It's high time that Congress address the flat earth policy and move forward with a plan that appropriately reflects marijuana's rapidly changing cultural status in America. And that's some of the news for Thursday, July 11th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Catherine Davis. Did a wonderful job. Thank you, Catherine. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.